I can see that you don't know very much about our legal system here. If you'll just let me explain it to you, you will understand in a jiffy how a man can live here and not live here at one and the same time.
Professor Wise, what are we going to see in the second lecture now?
Well, the second lecture is about the second story in the Tevye series. I think when he wrote the first story, he had no idea that he was ever going to write another. But it seems that he liked this character so much that after a year or so more, he decided to do something quite extraordinary. He brought his character, Tevye, together with a character whom he had created 3 years earlier called Menachem Mendel. And he brought them together for this one and only time in this second story in the Tevye series. And so here's Menachem Mendel. He is this, what you would, crazy entrepreneur, schemer, dreamer, and he's discovered the stock market.
Right.
So he is your first capitalist, but not the man who is actually with the capital and not the person who really is the broker of this capital or the real high-level investor. He is just your guy who is getting in on this deal, and he thinks, well, if there's money to be made in this magical new way, who better than me? So what you have is Menachem Mendel meeting Tevye. Tevye, who has just gotten a toehold on a real economic, secure way of making a living. How do these two fit? So what we have here, though, is a contrast. What a contrast between the first story, Tevye strikes it rich, and this second, Tevye blows a small fortune. Same dairyman, same location, serving the same customers, and only a couple of years older, is telling us the opposite story. Not about winning, but about losing. Not of what can go right in life, but what can go wrong. So we're entitled, I think we're almost obliged to ask, so what's going on? Was Tevye changed because he accumulated 100 rubles? Is this juxtaposition intended to make us wary and suspicious rather than hopeful? So what's the connection between episodes 1 and 2, if any? Or do they just stand side by side as a problem? So sometime after Tevye's first appearance, Shalom Aleichem turned to him again and did something striking. He brought Tevye together with another of his characters, Menachem Mendel, for their one and only fictional encounter. So Shalom Aleichem had created Menachem Mendel in 1892, which is 2.5 or 3 years before he introduced Tevye. So that Menachem Mendel was already a staple of Yiddish humor. People would say about a certain kind of person, he is a Menachem Mendel. He's a comic type in perpetual motion, always scheming and dreaming. Depending on your temperament and political outlook, you could emphasize either his compulsive optimism and his refusal to give in to failure, or his gullibility, his imprudence, his recklessness, and lack of consideration for others. Since Shalom Aleichem's readers would have been familiar with this Menachem Mendel type and with these stories, I think we should know a little bit about how he appears in the works that bear his name. Menachem Mendel is the hero of an epistolary fiction, that is, a story that is told through a series of letters, and these letters are between him and Shaina Shaindel, his wife, the mother of his children. He turns up in our story as a cousin of Tevye's wife, Golda, a third cousin, actually, a distant relative, but a blood relative of his wife, Golda. And this is a relation close enough to win him some trust and allegiance. But in the letters, he is an absentee husband who has gone out into the world to seek his fortune. And the letter exchange between him and Shaina Shaindel follows the same repetitive pattern. He has left his shtetl. Menachem Mendel, you see, is the product of a shtetl. He has left his town of Kasrilivke, which translates as the town of cheerful paupers, the town of the cheerfully poor. So he is left, this is also a town which Sholem Aleichem invented, a fictional version of towns. And he's gone off to the big city, ostensibly to collect his wife's dowry from the relative who was holding it, but he gets hooked on the stock exchange. And instead of returning home, he writes home about his exciting business ventures. And this is how he sounds in one of those letters that he writes to Shaina Shaindel. Yesterday, for example, I played the market for 50 rubles, and by noon today, I'd lost them all. But I haven't told you what playing the market is. You can buy futures for 50 rubles, or double that, or hedge until closing time. That's the time between Mincha and Maariv in Kaschilivke. Well, I bought short, the market was up, and there went my 50 smackaroos. That's how you play it. But don't worry, my dear. 50 smackaroos are nothing in Odessa. With God's help, my lucky number will come up, and so on. This is the same kind of investment that he proposes to Tevye. And any trained broker or investor would have recognized a novice. But Menachem Mendel is not the kind of man to learn from experience. A person of this kind, the Menachem Mendel kind, and he became a prototype of the kind, is called a Luftmensch, literally an air person, a person who lives on air, someone with his head in the clouds, economically a man without any identifiable steady work or profession. And here's the thing, according to one historian, an estimated 40% of Russian Jewish men fell into this category, right? Talk about the unemployed. So Menachem Mendel writes Shaina Shaindel about his magnificent schemes, and she, in her part of the exchange of letters, replies, cut your losses and come home. She says, I wasn't raised in a home where we bought and sold air, and God keep me from doing it now. From air you catch cold, mother says. Whoever heard of a grown man playing in a market? You'll make more sense if you wrote me in Turkish, right? So Menachem Mendel is not Bernie Madoff, right? He's not that variety of swindler who is running some pyramid scheme. He's merely enchanted by the novelty and the excitement and the promise of seeing money grow. But the wife needs him home, and she has no faith in his promises, and so the exchanges between them become more cutting and more comical as he keeps repeating the same cycle of plunging into something new, losing, and then starting over again. And this predictability is played completely for comic effect. So something interesting, the French Jewish philosopher Henri Bergson, who incidentally was born the same year as Sholem Aleichem, wrote about laughter, and he perceived that laughter can be caused by something mechanical encrusted on the living. This is a very interesting conception. He made a lot of that. What does he mean by that? For example, a person keeps tripping over the same object. So you often see this in films, in plays, where a person is walking along and then trips over something. The audience laughs. Then if he does it again, it's hilarious, right? Why is it hilarious? Well, Bergson analyzes this to say it's because you expect human behavior to be something living, adaptable, whereas the person acts mechanically. See, he acts as if he's just robotically going through this. So the idea of something mechanical encrusted on the living, I'm giving it very bare bones interpretation, but something of this kind he sees as being an occasion for laughter. And in this case, we see that it's because Menachem Mendel keeps going through the same doomed behavior over and over again. So in this letter exchange, both sides are equally stuck. He in flight, and she is the harridan housewife trying to rein in her husband. We are laughing in the Menachem Mendel stories at the characters. They show no self-awareness no adaptability, no evolution. Now, this is the stuff in our parlance, and I don't know whether you're too young for this, but this is the stuff of the Peanuts cartoons, where Lucy is always pulling away the football so that Charlie will take a fall. And the Jew is stuck in the same way in this unending cycle of hope and failure. When Menachem Mendel turns up in the Tevye story, the dynamics are very different. Tevye is Menachem Mendel's antithesis, the supremely responsible husband and father who consults his wife before he makes any significant move. Tevye is the more solid character, literally pulling his own weight sometimes. When his horse can't pull his wagon, he sometimes has to pull the wagon. So he literally is pulling his own weight in dairy products. And he was always responsive. Menachem Mendel acts, Tevye is acted upon. Menachem Mendel is impulsive, refuses to look before he leaps. Tevye thinks hard before taking a risk. And having once lost it in this episode, he never tries anything like it again. So Menachem Mendel stimulates Tevye. He infects Tevye with his enthusiasm in this second story. So what happens, as you know, is this. Tevye is in Yehupitz, making his deliveries, and he runs into his wife's distant relative, Menachem Mendel, who looks down and out, as though he could use a square meal. Menachem Mendel accepts the invitation, and both Tevye and his wife enjoy being able to extend hospitality. And this is so lovely. You see how far he's come. Now he is the one who is able to extend hospitality to others. But Menachem Mendel never relaxes. He has to be doing business, and he infects Tevye with the, as Hillel Halkin puts it, the itch to be rich. He talks Tevye into investing with him the 100 rubles that he has so painstakingly managed to save. They will be partners, splitting the profits, Tevye putting up the capital and Menachem Mendel doing the investing. No need to wonder about the outcome for anybody who knows Menachem Mendel. Menachem Mendel's ventures always crash. But how does this affect Tevye? So Tevye can't resist the temptation, and this will be the first of the challenges that we see him facing. What was this challenge? I think you could call it the new opportunities of capitalism. The first two episodes, and this one in particular, highlight the changing socioeconomic conditions and their effects on the Jews, who played an oversized role in the economic life of their host societies, and they were therefore disproportionately affected by economic developments. In the first story, Tevye was the beneficiary of the cooperation among Jews, but now we see that these close relatives, that is to say, these interrelated types, these fellow Jews, we see them cooperating in a much riskier venture. Shalom Aleichem exposes the characters to something that both promises and threatens their livelihood and security. In order to understand this, we are expected to know something about the conditions of Jews at the time. So, just very lightly, so first, Tsarist rulers then restricted Jews to a region known as the Pale of Settlement, an area of about 386,000 square miles from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. This was intended to curb the spread of the Jews and to prevent competition in the big cities, because they were not allowed into the large cities. You can look much of this up in sources like the Virtual Jewish Library or the YIVO Encyclopedia for Jewish Research. Both of these excellent resources are available online. So according to the census of 1897, almost 5 million Jews lived within those boundaries. They formed 94% of the total Jewish population of Russia and 11.6% of the general population of that area. Excluded from the pale, as I say, were the cities of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Kiev. Now you see what this means. This means that neither Tevye nor Menachem Mendel has any right to reside in Yehupetz, which is the fictional Kiev. Menachem Mendel has been living in Yehupetz illegally for almost a year and a half. He has to be there because that's the only place where he can take advantage of the new stock exchange. But he is not allowed to be there to compete with the others. So he is forced into illegality to exercise what should be a citizen's equal rights. When Tevye asks him about it, he says, shh, not so loud. I do live here, but that's strictly between the two of us. Tevye fails to understand. If you're hiding from the law, are you sure that the main street of Yehupetz is the place for it? Ask me no questions, Reb Tevye, he says. That's how it is. I can see that you don't know very much about our legal system here. If you'll just let me explain it to you, you will understand in a jiffy how a man can live here and not live here at one and the same time. So live here and not live here at one and the same time pretty precisely describes the situation of the Jew who is trying to survive in a world that intends to expel him. So you see how legally precarious, economically precarious, in every way precarious, this situation of Menachem Mendel is. That's first. Now, secondly, worse than the restrictions governing Jewish residence and opportunity were the selective exceptions that Alexander II granted to some Jews and not others. For example, to merchants who were able to pay a high registration fee in the guild, to dentists, midwives, and certain needed professionals. So Sholem Aleichem and the wealthy Jews in the first story who are vacationing in Boiberik, they are legally able to live in Kiev, but Tevye, who sells them these dairy products, was not. He could only sell his goods there during the day. And as a matter of fact, Sholem Aleichem, our author, had experienced these things personally because, as I mentioned, he had gone bankrupt. Until he went bankrupt, he was a merchant of a certain class, so he could legally reside in Kiev. But when he went bankrupt and had to flee, he could no longer reside in Kiev. And until he got enough money back so that he could reacquire his participation in the guild, his wife, Olga, studied dentistry so that she could get the legal permission to live in Kiev. So you see, when Sholem Aleichem, who is basically on a higher level, is writing about Tevye, he is writing about something that he knows for all that at first hand through his own experience and not only, you know, imaginatively. So Sholem Aleichem was very acutely aware that when everyone is in the same boat, they may benefit by pulling together, but a political economic wedge that splits the community is likely to undermine collective behavior and morale. So the lucky break in the first story is the Jews show unity in order to overcome what divides them. But in the second story, unity doesn't overcome the problem. In fact, the presumption of unity may encourage a false sense of trust. Now, neither Tevye nor Menachem Mendel is allowed to benefit from the capitalism that lets shareholders take part in an expanding economy. But Menachem Mendel does not intend to be shut out. When he discovers that ordinary people are allowed to invest in industries and projects that they could neither build nor possess, he intends to take advantage of this hugely democratizing moment. People who were not born into aristocracy can now be catapulted into the upper strata of society. Menachem Mendel loves capitalism's freedom as the ultimate engine of democracy. It upends inherited status and even professional standing in favor of those who successfully make and manage money. But this is a very hazardous business. There are no guarantees. One can lose as simply as one can win. more easily if you don't understand the rules or the odds. Tevye, who is still our speaker here and our main character here, Tevye's motives, as you see in getting into this, are mixed. He meets Menachem Mendel as a bedraggled loser. He takes pity on the man. This time, Tevye, as I say, is the benefactor of another Jew. But rather than Tevye's stability putting Menachem Mendel on a stronger footing, the speculator's instability pulls the stronger man down. Tevye is tempted, he succumbs, loses his investment, and never again recovers those precious 100 rubles. The impulse to help this struggling relative is no permanent benefit to either of them. So if one Jew helps the other, and if that in the first story works to Tevye's advantage, and if the help that he now extends works against him, it seems that Jewish solidarity is not in itself enough to guarantee that it will be an advantage. It all depends on the uses to which this is put. So the final thing to include as background to this second Tevye story was that it appeared in 1899 in Der Yid, the Jew. That's what it was called, Der Yid, a Yiddish publication established by the Zionist movement soon after the Zionist movement was founded. The weekly was founded in order to disseminate and strengthen the Zionist idea. That is where this story appeared, right? So Sholem Aleichem was by then one of the best known and most beloved Jewish writers, but it isn't immediately clear how either he or the editors or readers thought that this story was connected with a movement of national self-liberation. Maybe the editors included it because Sholem Aleichem was a big name, but they wouldn't have included it if it had violated the Zionist message. So we can in some ways wonder how this episode contributes to our understanding of the modern Jewish people as a modern Jewish people. Now, the Marxists, and believe me, at this time, 1897, the revolutionary movements were in full force in Russia, and Jews played a pretty big role in some of them. So the Marxists were very clear in their understanding of Menachem Mendel, both in his own stories and in this one. They adored him. They adored him because to them, he was the caricature of capitalism run amok. And this is how the critic Max Ehrich in the Soviet Union in 1935 describes the character he considered Sholem Aleichem's greatest creation. The central idea of Menachem Mendel, he writes, is the rejection of the possibility that the petty bourgeoisie will succeed through capitalism. Satire on the bourgeois illusions of the lower middle class, scathing, demolishing critique of the Luftmensch and his so-called livelihoods. So you see, Ehrich called the Menachem Mendel letters a great progressive work for the way it mocked the Jew who fell into the capitalist trap. And this is how Menachem Mendel remained in the Soviet Jewish imagination throughout, as long as there was a Soviet Union. And just to show you how big Menachem Mendel became in this, let's just see a clip of a 1925 Soviet movie, a silent film still, called Jewish Luck, Yiddische Glicken. It was made with Yiddish subtitles. It stars the person who was the greatest actor of the Soviet Union, Solomon Shloimeh Michoels. And this is Michoels playing the role of Menachem Mendel. This is a scene on the famous Odessa steps, and it is a scene of Menachem Mendel when he is playing the role of the matchmaker. And here he is running to meet someone who he thinks is going to be a very, very saleable prospective bride. you see to what extent this is a caricature. Michoel's, the way he walks, this caricature of the Jew of a certain kind. Menachem Mendel almost, you know, floating up the steps the way he walks. But all of it really heightened in a certain direction. And all of it to mock, right, this figure who believes that he's going to be, in this case, a matchmaker. And finally, at the end, as he does in the Menachem Mendel stories, he matches two brides. So that's, of course, how a Menachem Mendel adventure is bound to end. So this is how he is presented here in the Soviet Yiddish imagination, the great Shalom Aleichem figure that they loved, because they see in him, you see, the taking down of the capitalist possibility. And conversely, Max Ehrich, whom I quoted, has very little use for Tevye as the petit bourgeois Jew who wants to maintain his traditional way of life. Ehrich accused Shalom Aleichem of throwing a veil of idealization over Tevye instead of exposing his false traditionalism. You see, that's how this was understood, and I would say throughout the Yiddish world, throughout the Jewish world. But since Menachem Mendel appears in a story of Tevye and not the other way around, this could not have been Shalom Aleichem's intention. Tevye is indeed infected by dreams of wealth to the point that he's willing to invest with Menachem Mendel. We see him letting himself go in fantasies and daydream. But when the scheme fails, he slowly unravels and takes full share of responsibility for the loss. He absolves Menachem Mendel of blame, finally. Tevye is not reducible to mockery. He's able to criticize himself. After all, it's ridiculous to suppose, he says to Menachem Mendel, it's ridiculous to suppose that you did it on purpose because you were a partner just like me. Whose fault is it? It's my own for having been taken in by a lot of hot air. Take it from me. The only way to make money is to work your bottom off. It's just like it says in the Bible, Vitzaka Hanara, you can scream until you burst. Who says that anyone is listening? Wisdom and second thoughts are two things that always come too late. Tevye just wasn't meant to be upper crust. That's not how God wanted it. Hashem nasan, v'Hashem lakach. The God, the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. In which case, says Rashi, cheer up, my friend, and let's go have a shot of brandy. This is as close as we ever get to a moral of the story. If you're trying to figure out how to deal with the vicissitudes of life, you'd better not reach too far beyond what you can control, because even there you're guaranteed no security. And as far as capitalism is concerned, granted that it is liberating and irresistible, but the Jew also has to stay rooted in a steadier sense of reality. I'm interpreting this, but this is how I would see, more or less, if you wanted to draw a moral conclusion. Now, Tevye's very language in this conveys something very different from Menachem Mendel, who speaks in the terminology of options and poptions. Tevye experiences life, including this investment, through what one scholar calls the art of quotation. His narration draws so resourcefully from the well of Jewish sources as to make it an ongoing commentary on the Jewish way of life. Like in the passage just quoted, when Tevye pivots from bemoaning his loss to admitting his folly, he says, "V'tzoaka hana'ara." And I advise you always to look it up in the glossary if you are using this excellent edition, right? And what is this from? From Deuteronomy chapter 22, that sets out the laws of rape. The full passage reads, if the man comes upon an engaged girl in the open country, and the man lies with her by force, only the man who lay with her shall die, but you shall do nothing to the girl. The girl did not incur the death penalty, for the case is like that of a man attacking another and murdering him. He came upon her in the open, though the girl cried for help, v'tzoaka hanara, there was no one to save her. And then when Tevye adds, you can scream till you burst, who says that anyone is listening. He is declaring his innocence, issuing his cry, and acknowledging that no one is going to come to his assistance. And when he then sums up his loss in the phrase from the book of Job that is traditionally recited at funerals, God has given and God has taken, he's saying that it feels like a death. Paradoxically and humorously, these phrases and these sayings give him the means to fully express how violated he feels. What Tevye has absorbed from his tradition gives him an added register of language that Menachem Mendel lacks. And here you see it really in full force. He really wants to tell you how much pain he is. And you see from the two quotations that he draws right all together is really, you know, everything he's telling you. It's like a death, right? It's like a violation, and it's like a death. And he's innocent, but who cares? Who's going to listen? But Tevye will never give in to despair, in which case, says Rashi, cheer up and let's have a shot of brandy. After a funeral, one has to take something to quicken the spirits. Tevye is an interpreter of sources. I call him a comical Rashi. The art of quotation is his brandy, his pick-me-up. This referential richness, this improvisation, is why Tevye was interpreted very differently by mainstream Jewish critics than he was by the communists. They saw in him the Jew trying to keep his balance between an excess of hope and hopelessness. That is to say, the more traditional Jewish readers, and I would say the mainstream of Jewish criticism, Yiddish literary criticism, saw in Tevye someone who was trying to keep his psychological and moral balance. Shalom Aleichem said that he wrote to bring comfort to his people. And who better than Tevye to demonstrate the technique? So I think this in part tells us what this story was doing in a Zionist weekly. There was an argument at the heart of the Zionist movement between those who thought in material terms that the goal of recovering sovereignty in the land of Israel could be achieved by adding a dunam to a dunam and a cow to a cow. Facts on the ground. And between those who believed that it was first necessary to bring about a cultural transformation that would prepare the Jewish people for the recovery of their national sovereignty. Those who favored the slower approach were also split into different camps. Hebraists, like Eliezer ben Yehuda and Ahad Ha'am, knew that Hebrew would have to replace all other languages, especially Yiddish, since it was the only Jewish language that united the Jewish people through space and through time. And there were others like Shalom Aleichem, who was the furthest thing from an ideologue. And he knew that Yiddish was the common language of over 10 million Jews and the only language in which a man like Tevye could speak his mind, or a reader anywhere in the range of a Tevye could read a work. So some of the new culture would doubtless consist of rousing hymns, poems of national affirmation, but it was no less important to provide a cultural vocabulary that reflected some of the challenges facing the Jews, their weaknesses as well as their strengths. Shalom Aleichem and Tevye are the vocabulary for modern Jewish discussion. They provide these. If you can talk about your situation through the discussion of Menachem Mendel and Tevye and their interrelation. So readers recognized in Tevye and Menachem Mendel two Jewish psychological, national, and spiritual types, both struggling to survive against political odds. Tevye says over and over again that a Jew cannot live without faith. This is as true for him in the modern world as it was in ancient times. Menachem Mendel is the instinct of faith, either a caricature of the messianic impulse or its embodiment. He represents the principle that drives Jews never to weigh the odds or to consider the cost of survival. He is the bridegroom who is afloat in the paintings of Marc Chagall. Tevye's belief is greatly tempered by experience, And his is the harder struggle. He has to keep going, knowing the adversity he faces, taking every blow in stride. So on the eve of the Second World War, in 1939, the writer Yechiel Yeshaya Trunk, whose dates are 1997 to 1961, younger than Shalom Aleichem by a generation, he wrote a book called Tevye and Menachem Mendel in Jewish Destiny. Tevye and Menachem Mendel in Yiddishen Weltgeurel, interpreting these two characters as the embodiment of the way the Jewish people in its entirety confronts its destiny in modern times, a destiny that's not only troubled, but tragic because of the overpowering enmity that Jews confront. And how does he see them? He sees Tevye as a figure of ironic resignation, who never gives up the covenantal contract with the Almighty, but is well aware of the disparity between God's promise and Jewish experience. The back and forth in Tevye's prayer between affirmation and protest conveys this precarious balance. Menachem Mendel, for his part, is the inborn hopefulness that never concedes to rational disproof. So at first, this is so interesting. At first, Trunk tells us that, of course, he valued Tevye much higher for his sanity and moral balance. He finds Tevye intellectually more mature, the better model. But when Trunk had to flee from the Nazis, he found that Tevye's balance could not stand up against the insanity of Europe. He needed Menachem Mendel's transcendent hopes that could never be quelled. Menachem Mendel seemed psychologically impervious to failure, and Trunk took this as his model of resistance in extreme case. So Trunk, this very sophisticated writer, who had lived his life as a sophisticated European, had to call on Menachem Mendel's impracticality during the Shoah. Now you may be sitting here and thinking, wait a minute, is this the story that we just read about a dairyman who gets the itch to be rich and lets himself be talked into some cockamamie scheme by a deadbeat speculator who, instead of asking for a handout, tries to sell him on an investment that he doesn't know the first thing about? You mean to tell me that this plot, that's worthy of some half-hour sitcom, triggered an argument over its interpretation between Jewish communists and nationalists about which of their worldviews it actually serves? Are you saying that this, am I saying this because I know what happened in the decades after this story appeared? For example, that Max Ehrich, who went to the Soviet Union, who saw only the caricature of Menachem Mendel, died in Stalin's gulag, and that others were shot in his prisons, in Stalin's prisons, and because Shalom Aleichem's Tevyes were victims of the Final Solution, is that why we're trying to attach some retroactive significance to the story, as though it foreshadowed those events? Wasn't this intended just as light entertainment, and wasn't that its achievement? Well, I would say entertainment, certainly, for sure. Shalom Aleichem always said that he had a talent for mimicry, and I would be doing this story a disservice if I in any way slighted the laughter that it provides, even though I haven't provided very much of it. But Shalom Aleichem's genius was to see the accumulation of Jewish wisdom in Jewish humor and to channel that incongruity into his fiction. So Shalom Aleichem's Jewish hero, you see, is not a Clark Kent who sheds his nerdy self to become Superman. And he is not the Superman who deep down under his uniform knows that he is Clark Kent. He is not a bifurcated hero, but the ordinary Jew who extraordinarily manages to be both these things at once. He is like the biblical Isaiah and Job, refined through Rashi and Yiddish folklore. Speech is as yet the only source of his power, right? Having not yet acquired any other independent means of self-defense. So Shalom Aleichem gives us that power at its source. And writing in a Zionist publication, he still leaves it to others to supply any other forms of protection that Zionism may find necessary to acquire. Thus far, the second episode.
Professor Weiss, could you just review some of the conclusions we should have in mind as we leave Lecture 2 and prepare for the next one?
Well, I think it's sobering. The conclusion that we have really brings us down to earth with a bang. If we thought that the beginning of the Tevye stories was going to introduce us into this marvelous formula for Jewish survival, that is to say, the rich and the poor, the big city people and the country people, the more educated and the less educated, are somehow or other going to be able to work together, and this relationship between them is going to be the foundations of a strong modern people, the come away from the first lecture. All of this is exploded in the second lecture. Now, what's the takeaway from this? Well, one of the things that I tried to show is it depended very, very much on where you stood politically and philosophically as to how you interpreted this. Of course, the left, the communists, the whole rising socialist movement saw Menachem Mendel as a caricature of capitalism. This is, you see what happens? This is what capitalism does to you. But on the other hand, the amazing thing is that there were others who saw in him the messianic impulse. And we see that these two things could not be farther apart. How can the same story suggest to one person that this is a satire of capitalism run amok, and to someone else that this is the Jewish messianic impulse unleashed in the world? Well, there you have it.